Hello and welcome to Risky Business number 148. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's edition of Risky Business is brought to you by Checkpoint Software. Thanks, Checkpoint. And this week we're chatting with Paul Ducklin in the feature interview. He works for Sophos and he's quite well known in the Australian security scene. He'll be joining us to lay into some researchers in the security industry who he says are a bit too pleased with themselves. Specifically, he's having a go at people who've written mobile malware as an academic exercise, which Duck argues is pointless.
Write a piece of malware as though no one ever thought of that before, announce this as though it's research, and then sit back, it seems, with a smug smile on your face as though you've saved planet Earth. You know, we know it's possible, so it's not really rowing the boat out at all. It's just saying, hey, I'm a smart coder, and I can write malevolent code instead of good code.
After that interview, we chat with Checkpoint's Frederick Boyesson in this week's sponsor interview. But first, as always, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, in this first story for the week, Optus, which is Australia's second largest telecommunications provider, has been absolutely slammed by a DDoS attack, apparently.
Yeah, so it's interesting that they've been so open about this. I mean, I think it's quite cool. There's we get obviously denial of service attacks over here with ISPs and telcos, but very rarely do they come out and actually disclose that it's happened. And I guess there aren't any statistics about kind of how much traffic and how long and from where to where. But it's good that they are at least being kind of open with their customers and with the public. People need to understand that this infrastructure is fallible and that if you throw a couple of hundred megabit or gigabit or whatever of traffic's being thrown around at someone's network, then it is going to go boom, and you need to have a plan for dealing with it.
Yeah, now according to this story by a friend of mine, actually, Andrew Colley from The Australian, he has reported that an Optus spokeswoman has confirmed that a denial of service attack on one of the carrier's business customers swamped the link, slowing down internet traffic to a trickle. And that, I believe, affected most of their business customers, which caused all sorts of headaches for enterprise customers who were doing stuff like, offshore spam filtering services and things like that, really caused a lot of headaches out there in the Australian enterprise. So, yeah, bummer, but at least we know what happened.
Exactly, yes.
All right. Now, moving on to this. Look, last week I think we briefly discussed a flaw in Java, which was a pretty bad one. It's being exploited in the wild already.
Yeah, which is great. The this bug is just embarrassing, right? It's a really quite a trivial sort of bug in the Java Web Start infrastructure, and I'm not at all surprised that we're seeing it being used. And I believe that it was actually already being used whilst it was undisclosed anyway, because it is. It's such an obvious looking bug, and once you look at it, the mechanism by which you exploit it is pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not surprised at all. And, I think the general advice here is that at the moment, it's just not safe to run Java in your browser. The number of flaws we've seen recently, and of course, the tardiness of most enterprises in patching their Java runtimes anyway, makes it sort of the Javocalypse, as one blogger has dubbed it.
The Javocalypse. Yeah, tell us more about that. I caught that blog post. Where did that come from? Crowblog or something?
Yeah, the CR0. It's Julian Tyne from Google. So there's actually been a number of Java bugs recently, and one was this Java Web Start bug, which is pretty embarrassing. And then there's been some discussion again of sandbox escape bugs. There was one back in about 2005, which was disclosed by a guy called Sami Koivu, I think. I'm not sure of the pronunciation. Which was a new bug class of sandbox escape bugs, and that was exploited quite widely over the years since then. And another one of another bug has been found in that same class, along with a whole other way of breaking out of the Java sandbox by the same guy. And basically these are I read the technical description of these bugs in the Java sandbox validator, and they're just mind-bendingly complicated and very, very hard to follow. And you can completely understand how they made the mistake, but in terms of patching them, right, that's it's not going to be a fun place for anybody. There's sort of a perfect storm brewing of Java bugs combined with Java's new owner being that particularly responsible security focused organization that we all love to bag on. So yeah,
the company whose name we shall not mention.
Yes, we shall not speak its name.
That's right, Oracle. But
crazylarry.com.
But yeah, look, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if their security patching winds up slowing down. Look, I don't even know what it was like before, but I can't really imagine that the patch cycles will have been tremendously effective so far since the acquisition.
Well, no, of course not. And, you know, you look at the other vendors that deploy Java runtimes. Apple, I suppose, is a particularly good example. Mm. Right? And actually getting these things patched across all the runtime providers, and especially when it's something that is almost a design-level issue in terms of implementation, you know, in the Java runtimes. So, you know, you've got to get that patched across IBM's runtime and, you know, the BA Oracle runtimes and the Apple ones and the OpenJDK, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of places, and actually getting all of that patched and then deploying them to everyone who uses them, right? It's just, yeah, we're going to be seeing people exploiting these bugs, I think, for a long time.
So basically your advice is if you can avoid using Java, don't use Java.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. If you don't need it in your browser, turn it the hell off.
Yeah.
And apparently if you're running Chrome and you turn off the plugins, then Java still works or something.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Google.
Thank you.
All right, well, on to this next story, and this comes to us via cnetnews.com. And look, I think the headline says it all. 88% of firms show Zeus botnet activity. Lol.
Yeah, and man, if you're the guys controlling that botnet and you got into the market of, you know, selling corporate data that you've stolen, yep, they're sitting on a gold mine.
Yeah,
man.
Look, according to this story, 88% of the Fortune 500 may be affected by Zeus, which means, yeah, you know, you want access to this company, I can sell it to you. You want access to that company, I can sell it to you. I mean, there's your foothold in a network right there, isn't it? I mean, this data comes to us via news.com, but it's based on a report by RSA's Fraud Action Anti-Trojan Service. Sounds cool.
Fat. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Fat. Yeah, and I noticed that fraud action is one word.
Yes.
Of course, not even hyphenated. Just make it a word.
Not even hyphenated. Nope. Yes. All one word. Just bodge them together, whack an extra capital in the ear, done. You're done.
I mean, look, no, do you buy this? I mean, do you buy that 88% could be infected? I mean, of course, Fortune 500 companies are going to have a damn load, you know, an absolute truckload of workstations, so I find it quite plausible.
Well, yeah, though I thought it was interesting that in the article from CNET, it actually says companies with fewer than 75,000 employees appeared to have highest ratio of botnet activity. 75,000 employees. Like, I'm pretty sure we don't have any companies in New Zealand that are even slightly that big.
Yeah, look, I mean, I recently had occasion to look at some AV stuff inside a really large network. And, you know, when you start looking at infection rates, say your infection rate is 0.5%, right? And you've got, say, 300,000 networks. I mean, that's 1,500 boxes, right?
Yeah, and it only takes one, you know.
That's right. So, I mean, it's not that surprising when you think about it. It only takes one to make this RSA list, and you know, you'd be very lucky to get an infection rate of 0.5% anyway, considering the technology is only around 70% effective at best. So, you know, I mean, I think it's really the defense in depth approach that prevents infection rates from being a lot worse. But I certainly think completely eradicating viruses from a network of 75,000 nodes is not feasible.
No, I would agree with you completely. But unfortunately, hackers don't give a shit that it's not feasible and they're going to carry on doing it, you know?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a, you know, you look at the story about Google and the, you know, advanced persistent threats and stuff. Well, there's nothing new there, right? This is, you know, we've had viruses and malware inside corporate networks forever, and we're going to continue to have them, and we have to deal with what that means, you know?
Well, mate, I can tell you that with the advanced persistent threats, that some marketing manager out there got a bonus that month because that terminology has stuck.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, someone's should be charging us every time we say it. Maybe we should put it on the list along with, you know, Cyber Armageddon and low-hanging fruit.
No, that was Wired, Cyber Armageddon. That's tongue firmly in cheek, that one.
No, we'll stick it in with the low-hanging fruit category then.
Excellent.
Not allowed to say it on the show anymore. No more advanced persistent threats.
Now, to some more news from home, and this is a curious one, written by a young journalist at ZDNet Australia, Ben Grubb, which loudly proclaims that China has been DDoSing Rupert Murdoch. But I read this story, I thought, is this a beat up? And I thought, actually, no, it's kind of quite interesting, because it's about the websites of News Limited companies here in Australia being DDoSed and then having notes sent along to editors and stuff saying, we'll stop the attack if you remove this story or take this story down, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, my initial reaction reading this piece was like, yeah, sure, right, buddy. But, you know, and I would like to see, I guess, some more evidence and detail that, you know, to suggest that it is actually what was going on and that, you know, it is actually the Chinese government and the sort of stories they're trying to get pulled. But, yeah, this story just, you know, it smells a little fishy. Well, at least I would like to believe that it smells fishy. And that, you know, the Chinese government aren't DDoSing news sites in the West to, yeah, to take down articles they don't like.
What I can't believe, I mean, here is the whole story hinges on an interview with News Limited's Australian IT security manager, who's a bloke called Bob Hinch. And it looks like what's happened is Ben has attended some sort of event, seen a bit of a talk, followed up and spoken to the bloke. And, you know, he says, you know, there's a paragraph here, I'll quote from it. Many of the attacks originated, quote, especially, end quote, from the Chinese government, according to Hinch, and they occurred when something written by one of News Limited's journalists hit a raw nerve and wasn't in favour of the attacker's view. It depends on the story you're running, he is quoted as saying. And then the following paragraph, Hinch told ZDNet Australia that the attacks were growing more and more political and they weren't stopping. Now, that is a pretty sensational claim to be making to a journalist.
It is. I agree. Like, it's, you know, you would want to have your position pretty clear and well backed up, especially when you're working for an organization that understands, you know, the power of news, like News Limited. I mean, that's, yeah, it's quite surprising, really, isn't it?
It is. It is. I mean, it's not like the guy can readily prove it either.
No, well, exactly. Yeah, which is, I suppose, why I'd like to see some of the raw data so that we could draw our own conclusion about what's going on.
I don't think you're going to see that data, do you?
No, I don't think I am either. Although what I could do is run some nasty articles about Chinese government and wait for the packets.
That's a good idea, man. Yeah. We could do like a honeypot of like, let's write something really mean about the Chinese government.
But that shouldn't be too hard.
It shouldn't be too hard. Tiananmen?
Yeah, mm-hmm, that's a good start.
Falun Gong?
Another one, yep. Mm-hmm.
Tibet.
Tibet, that's always a good choice, yes.
Jailing journalists.
Mm-hmm. That's a good choice as well.
Hacking into human rights people's email. Naughty.
Oh, yeah, on both Yahoo, Hong Kong and Gmail.
Now, if we combine this into one story, we're guaranteed a DDoS.
Absolutely, yeah. That would be great.
All right, moving on. Anyway, another story which kind of has local roots here, and the company Atlassian. I'm sure, well, I presume you've heard of Atlassian. They're actually an Australian company, and they have warned their customers that they've been pwned.
Yeah, so this is interesting. It's kind of tied up with the compromise at Apache.org and the Apache Software Foundation just recently. And they it appears that Atlassian, who make, amongst other things, the Jira bug tracking software, at some point got themselves owned, and they had a legacy database that contained a bunch of clear text passwords. So they apparently had migrated away from that particular system and were hashing the passwords from July 2008 onwards. But their old database with clear text passwords was just lying around on the database server and appears to have been stolen.
Oh, no.
So, yes, they're advising everybody to change their passwords.
So if you're an Atlassian customer, change your goddamn password.
Indeed, and don't use the same password on all sorts of crappy websites.
And as you mentioned, Apache.org was hit by some sort of cross-site scripting attack that someone managed to leverage access into the thing and get some passwords. And tell me about it, because I'm confused. I'm permanently confused, but I'm even more confused about this. What happened?
The Apache Software Foundation came out with a report that they had been hacked. And, you know, traditionally, Apache have been pretty open discussing exactly how this has happened. And it's a very useful insight into, you know, sort of the way that you can leverage something that, as simple as a cross-site scripting into, in this case, you know, full root access to a box. So they attacked a cross-site scripting vulnerability in the Jira bug tracker, which the Apache Software Foundation use. And then they used that. Well, they posted a bug which contained a tiny URL link that exploited the cross-site scripting attack and then waited for someone with administrative privilege in the bug tracker to click on it. So they clicked on it. They got access to the administrative interface. From there, they uploaded some JSP, like a JSP reverse shell, got it executed in the context of the bug tracker, which gave them, you know, access to run commands locally with the privilege of the bug tracker. And then from there, they were able to collect passwords of people logging into the bug tracker. And then one of those users had the same password for a shell account, and he had sudo access as to execute any command as root. And from that point, they rooted the box. From there, they actually tried to escalate privilege across into some of the other Apache systems, but about that time they were noticed and shut down. I think they ended up on the main Apache shell host, but didn't manage to root that, it appears.
Man, that's actually a pretty decent little attack. Hey? I mean, leveraging, I mean, everyone talks about, oh, cross-site scripting, it doesn't really matter, you know. OWASP top 10 stuff, you know, who cares? No one uses that stuff. And, you know, here we've seen Apache.org compromised through a cross-site scripting bug.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, it's classic bug chaining. This is how we do it.
And I like the idea that, you know, what they did to leverage the cross-site scripting bug was actually, you know, to submit it through their bug through submission the bug process. Tracking, I mean, yeah. It's the ultimate spearfish, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, very nicely done, you know.
Yep, yep.
Golf clap to them.
So to you bad guys out there, we begrudgingly say kudos to you.
Yeah, nicely done.
Nicely done. But you got a little bit sloppy and that's why you got noticed. Ha ha. Now, in this next story, this is an interesting one, actually. You know, we're always seeing scareware-style malware, but this is an awesome new twist on it. There's a bit of malware out there that pretends to be... basically, you get a message along the lines of, you have been detected using peer-to-peer networks. We are the recording industry and we're going to sue your ass, you know, unless you settle out of court for $400 right now, you know... Here's how you pay.
Yeah, the it's actually quite a smooth scam, right? I mean, if it pops up a nice looking dialogue box, and you know, it's sort of it suggests that if you pay them, you know, $400 or whatever it is via credit card, that you'll have the right to use the content you just pirated, which is nice, right? I mean, that would probably work, and you know, as a business model for some people, it's almost plausible. But the funny thing is, like, they go to all this effort to build this, the system, and it's quite, you know, it looks nice. They've done a good job of it, and then the payment gateway looks kind of legit and stuff, and it doesn't actually bill your credit card. They just store the details for later, presumably to sell or were actually used to defraud you. But after all that effort, they still make spelling mistakes in the damn interface. Like, they spell lawsuit wrong.
Nice.
You know, central tenet of their scam is you're trying to avoid a lawsuit. They spell lawsuit wrong.
It is kind of sad when most of the underworld's activities can be defeated via a spell check, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and you think if you're going to go to this much effort, you'd at least spell check the text, you know, get a copywriter, you know, something, please, yeah. Guys.
Yeah, that's that's a little bit sad. More news from the world of botnets. This is kind of an interesting little nugget of info that came to us via Secure Computing Magazine in the US. Botnet disconnections apparently have very little impact on the general amount of spam out there.
Yeah, so according to the study according to the report by Google Postini, they were correlating the global spam volumes versus the takedowns of various botnets we've seen in the last kind of 12 months or so. And they're asserting that there isn't any real correlation. And I suppose the thing that we conclude from that is that there are actually more botnets than there are resources required to send spam.
I think economists would call this oversupply.
Well, exactly, yes. Yeah. And that there's no, certainly no challenge in acquiring enough capacity to do all the spamming that you want.
Virus-infected computers, not as rare as hen's teeth.
Big surprise there.
Not as rare as rocking horse shit, as my dad would say.
Yeah, well, you know, top 500, what were we saying earlier on? 80%?
That's right.
That's a lot of rocking
horse
shit.
There are a few virus-infected computers out there.
Just, yeah, a couple.
There's a couple. Anyway, moving on to that. I just thought that was an interesting little factoid. Moving on, and a bloke, this comes to us via Wired's excellent threat level blog written by Kim Zetter, this piece. A guy who worked for the Bank of America in the United States has pled guilty to installing malware on 100 ATMs, and he managed to skim something like $300,000 over a 7-month period.
Yeah, so he was some manner of software developer for the Bank of America, and yeah, he slipped some malware in which apparently allowed him to withdraw cash from the ATMs without generating any audit trail. Now, you know, I would have thought that the money going missing kind of counts as a bit of an audit trail, and he's probably discovering that now that he's facing 5 years in prison.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose, you know, given if you're going to go to the effort of backdooring ATMs, $300,000 doesn't seem like a lot of money.
That's in 7 months, man. It's not too bad.
It's not too bad. But I mean, given that you're going to be on the lam for the rest of your life, you may as well make a bit more than that.
You don't pay tax on that either.
True, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
It's tax-free income.
Tax-free.
There are many benefits to joining the criminal underworld. I don't think you get dental, though.
No.
But, I mean, that is a fair bit. That's a fair whack of cash. I don't know if you heard last week's show, we had a chat to Kimberly Zenz, and, you know, she's been seeing a bunch of this ATM malware. I mean, ATM malware is everywhere now, and there's more and more variants, more and more versions popping up. I think this is something we're going to see an absolute ton more of. And it's not just people on the inside of bank networks and stuff who can install this stuff. It's, you know, if you get access to the USB panel on these things, you got physical access to some of these things, you know, bang, there you go. Oh, the coolest thing is too, I've heard that some of these some of these bank Trojans, right? You actually go up, you're the bad guy. You go up to the Trojan, you enter in a special code, and it brings up a menu, like a bad guy menu. And there's various options for how you can get the data, the captured data, off the device. And one of them is to actually use the receipt printer. Now, we've heard of that before, but a new feature, I mean, it's the first time I've heard of it anyway. You can actually print off the data that's encrypted with the key of the bad guy, right? So the bad guy can send a mule to go and collect the data without worrying that the mule is going to piss off with the information.
Yeah, well, that's pretty sophisticated, I guess. You know, it makes
good
sense.
Use of crypto.
Yeah. Yeah, well, but, why not, right?
Yeah, I just have this sneaking suspicion that ATM malware is going to be a real problem for people working in banking in 2010.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel more twitchy about using ATMs than I ever have in the past. You know, walking up, sticking the card in, checking for the skimmer, checking for the camera, and you go, now I'm supposed to check for malware on the ATM that's running Windows, you know?
But you're just a twitchy guy.
Well, exactly, yeah. And I guess I don't have much money to steal anyway.
Twitchy beardy guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's an interesting story. Now, I picked this one out because I thought it would warm your heart, which is a stock brokerage in the United States has been fined $375,000 for failing to adequately protect data from a bunch of Latvian hackers. And I mean, you know, ever since then, they've actually had to, this brokerage house has actually had to downgrade the quality of coffee bean used in their espresso machines. I mean, it's had a real impact.
That's a real impact right there. Mm-hmm. Now they have to have what, Starbucks beans or what?
Nothing that bad. I mean, they're not the finest from Sumatra anymore. I mean, that's all I've heard.
Yeah, so apparently this particular brokerage firm were attacked via SQL injection. You know, OWASP top 10, number one there, guys, good going. And then some people bust in, stole 200,000-ish customers worth of details. And then subsequently they reported it to the police, and the guys got caught and prosecuted. Or at least some of the guys involved got caught and prosecuted. And then they've subsequently been, fined by some financial regulator for failing to follow the results of a security audit they were given. So that means people like me go in and write reports for financial institutions.
And go fix this glaringly obvious SQL injection, you dumbass, and then they don't, and they get owned, and now they get fined.
It's great, isn't it?
It is.
It is a wonderful thing. Yeah, this warms my heart. It means all the stupid things that I write in my recommendations, somewhere, someone is actually going to get in trouble for not doing it.
Yeah, and I bet your ass that it doesn't cost $375,000 to fix a SQL injection bug.
Well, no, but I think they were recommended to install, you know, intrusion detection systems, and they didn't, and they were told to read their logs, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. $375,000 for not reading your damn logs, like fucking A, is what I say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, another interesting aspect to this story is that the fraudsters, or the people who actually stole the data, didn't actually try, you know, leveraging it to perpetrate any sort of fraud on the customers. They actually tried to extort the company and actually get about $80,000 for the return of the database or destruction of the database or whatever from the brokerage firm as like hush money. But
it doesn't seem like a particularly good business model there.
Well, Adam, that actually takes us to the end of the week's news. Thank you for joining us, as always, and we'll chat to you next week.
Not a problem, man. I will look forward to it.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news. Moving on to the show, and it's time for this week's feature interview, and we're bringing back a regular from Risky Business in 2009, Mr. Paul Ducklin. Paul works for Sophos, a company that supported this podcast last year, so many of you will remember him from his sponsor interviews throughout 2009. Sophos is no longer a sponsor of the show, but what can we say? We missed Duck, so we thought we'd get him back on the show for a chat. Now, Paul has some very interesting and considered opinions on this industry of ours, and he's not afraid to air some that run against popular opinion. Today, we're chatting with Paul about some academic and commercial researchers who've been creating and releasing malware and Trojans for mobile platforms. It's true, too. Researchers from Rutgers University and indeed from one of our sponsors, Vericode, have been busy writing and releasing mobile malware for various platforms. They say by creating this malware, they'll be able to respond to it better when the real thing arrives. But Paul thinks it's counterproductive and, frankly, it seems to piss him off a little bit. He joined me by phone from Sydney last week for this interview.
I'm actually pretty annoyed. I mean, a lot of the research is fine, but there does seem to be this sort of unavoidable pattern by some practitioners in academic and quasi-academic research to write a piece of malware as though no one ever thought of that before, announce this as though it's research, write it up, get loads of media interest, and then you sort of sit back, it seems, with a smug smile on your face, as though you've saved planet Earth. And I presume the reason this is more prevalent for mobile malware than regular malware is there isn't much mobile malware, so it still draws a bit of a gasp from the adoring public. But it just defeats me why writing malware helps us improve the defences.
It's a bit of an academic exercise. It's a bit of a navel-gazing thingy.
But surely we would expect more from academia.
Well,
guys at Rutgers, for example, they wrote they said, we're going to write this rootkit for mobile phones to prove it's possible. So what they did is they wrote a malware which disguises its presence, because you send it an SMS to turn on the spyware capability and it deletes the SMS. So there's the rootkittery. You know, it's manipulating the phone. And their research, they're saying, what we're doing, this is, I'm reading from their own sort of self-congratulatory press release, we're showing that people with general computer proficiency can create rootkit malware for smartphones. The next step is to work on defenses. Well, wouldn't that be a good first step? We know it's possible. We know that anybody with general proficiency or even with lightweight proficiency, think of the IKEA worm from last year from Wollongong, if you don't mind. We know that it's possible to write the malware. What we don't know or what we don't have are excellent defensive strategies for mobile phones these days. A lot of it seems to go on trust. So I just don't get why it's research. Some of the guys doing this are really proud about how they've created this open source malware and they've released the source code for the greater good of all. This is from, I forget what conference this was at. Was this at this was at ShmooCon, I think. So this is from this guy's blog from March this year. And he's saying, as I'm sure you are aware, I released a fully functional piece of BlackBerry spyware called Tuxus BB Spy at the ShmooCon Security Conference. Yeah, there you are. And I've done a number of interviews and podcasts on the topic. It's a rather self-congratulatory blog. And he says, while my research is interesting, well, maybe it is to you, other high-profile attacks just this week could really make this type of spyware a lot more dangerous. What? And this is research? I just don't get it. Sorry.
Well, actually, I am familiar with that one, Duck, because that particular bit of research was done by a bloke called Tyler Shields, who works for Veracode, which is actually a sponsor of this podcast. Now, what they had basically done, I mean, the way, you know, one of the podcasts that he was on was this one. And what he, you know, the rationale behind doing the research on BlackBerry spyware was Veracode makes code scanners. Okay, so they wanted to basically look at what they did, a pretty detailed analysis of the Dubai sort of spyware app for BlackBerries when it came out last year.
I was going to get to that as more than just a proof of concept.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what they decided to do was to actually create their own one, because they thought that was a pretty poor implementation. And what they wanted to do was to actually create one that was a good implementation, and then they could actually model the behavior of that software so that they would have a better idea of how to spot rogue code in things like application stores and stuff like that. They could actually scan the code and look for stuff that behaves as a BlackBerry data exfiltration bit of code should. So it does seem that they have legitimate reasons for that research. No?
Well, yeah, I've heard this before. I remember in the heady old days of boot sector viruses, late 80s, early 90s, when people were trying to put neural nets to work detecting boot sector viruses. Because if you think in a boot sector, 512 bytes, very synthetic sort of environment, not much of an operating system, just the BIOS. So there's a limit, there's a reasonable limit to what you need for a so-called good boot sector. And the problem the guys had with training neural networks is there were quite a lot of viruses, but not much good code. And I guess I can understand in this case, there's the opposite. There's quite a lot of good code and not much malware. But I don't see why you actually need to create, to say that it's interesting that you wrote an open source a piece of spyware. You don't need to do that to model how you might identify different patterns of software behavior on a phone.
You don't think it would be helpful?
What? Why you would open source it?
Oh, well, not the open sourcing it part, but the actual creating it part.
Well, I'm sure it would be interesting, but is it important? Does it help us defend? Not really. They've written a piece of malware, and then they've written something which knows how to retrospectively how to analyze that behavior. That doesn't really help, because it's sort of, you know, like curing your own disease or going, hey,
but that's the whole security industry in a nutshell, Duck. I mean, look at vulnerability research, huh?
Oh, you mean the issue of buying exploits?
Well, even the issue of just creating them in the first place. I mean, your logic can actually be applied to make vulnerability research look like it's not really doing us much good.
I I thought of that counter-argument because I thought, is what I'm saying that we shouldn't do vulnerability research or come up with new exploits? Now, I haven't made my sort of moral stroke conscience mind up about the, you know, things like the zero-day initiative and all that stuff for buying exploits. So let's not go there for the moment, although the Tipping Point guys are one of those who've written a botnet app for, I think, BlackBerry or iPhone and Android and not released it, but messed around with it, which I think is a bit silly. But the thing is, if you look at vulnerability research and exploit uncovery, look at something like what your friend of mine, Mr. Dowd, does, for example. What you're uncovering there is new vectors by which an attack might be mounted against somebody else's software. Particularly interesting if it's closed source software like Microsoft Windows, for example. So at least you're actually uncovering something new or something that nobody had thought of before, for example, as a vehicle to bypass DEP or something like that, or a vehicle to bypass address space randomization. So I can see why that's important, provided you practice responsible disclosure, because it actually shows that you're able to achieve results which other people might have originally thought impossible. In other words, you're actually going past security defenses which are already in place and believed to work. But in the case of, you know, writing mobile phone spyware, we already know it's possible. As you said, the guys in the UAE, Eti Salat, or however you pronounce it, they did that in the middle of last year. Mobile phone viruses that spread by Bluetooth, 2004, the Kabir virus, the iKey malware for iPhones, and the Derb virus, which shortly followed it. You know, we know it's possible, so it's not really rowing the boat out at all. It's just saying, hey, I'm a smart coder, and if I don't concentrate hard enough, I can write malevolent code instead of good code. Whereas I think the sort of work that Dowd et al. Do, where they're actually uncovering strange and unusual ways of bypassing security which people believe already works, I do see that as beneficial, as I said, particularly if there's responsible disclosure of what they find that actually helps everyone raise their defenses. Writing a new piece of malware, I don't see how that raises our defenses.
Okay. Well, let's twist the argument just a little bit in a different direction. What about something like Metasploit, which is which has been a bit of a game changer? I speak to people in, you know, very much in similar positions to you. They work for companies that are, you know, most commonly associated with being anti-malware companies. And they say that, you know, within hours of an O-Day finding its way into Metasploit, like an IE O-Day, it's out there in the wild infecting people. So in that regard, you know, it's quite a damaging thing. But then there's other people who would argue that Metasploit is actually a really good thing because it's given that capability to the good guys as well as the bad. I mean, what's your take on that? Is Metasploit evil?
I haven't quite decided yet. A large part of me wishes that it weren't there for exactly this, exactly that reason you mentioned, that it's become this sort of triumphant vehicle by which you announce, publicize, and disseminate O-Days so that anyone can make them work, take the code, adapt it, and use it. So a large part of me says, I wish that weren't there. There is still a difference to writing, you know, a bit of spyware for a mobile phone, though, at least in that that somebody is uncovering and demonstrating something which is new, which is novel, and does need some new mechanism for defending against. So, yeah, I guess Metasploit, it's sort of like duct tape, really. You know, what it's got a dark side and a sticky side, and holds the universe together.
I think H.D. Moore is actually really going to like that description.
Metasploit can be very useful, and it can certainly help bona fide researchers uncover new information about how to protect against O-Days and to understand them fairly easily because of the fact that it's open and public. On the other hand, I think sometimes there does seem to be some sort of self-congratulatory aspect to it for some of the contributions which go in there and get published, and that. So there is a tendency for the information in there to get abused. As you've said, yeah. O-Day gets publicized, everyone borrows it. But I still think that is a step above just writing, just, you know, proving something which we've already known for ages, whereas at least uncovering a new O-Day, by definition, because it's an O-Day, it's something we didn't know about before and that we assumed we were secure against. So at least it does row the boat out a little bit further and help us improve.
Look, I don't know. I don't know whether or not I agree with you, Paul, because for the simple fact that...
Well, you think Metasploit's bad? Wholly bad?
No, I'm talking more about the BlackBerry stuff, right? Because I think there is a legitimate reason. If you're working for a company whose products are designed to spot types of code, not signature-based matching, but types of code that perform certain types of functions, and one of the things that you're looking to detect is data exfiltration code, right? I think it makes sense to write some. I really do, because then you're going to know how that code interacts with the BlackBerry OS. You're going
But you don't need to write a piece of spyware to do that. And you don't need to write a program which disguises itself as something that it's not, etc. In other words, to go through the whole sort of I am an elite malware author sort of stage. You could just write chunks of legitimate code that exercise the various functions that you wish, the behavior of which you wish to observe.
Paul, just let me cut you off there, but it seems that the problem here isn't actually any material impact on the security of the greater good. It seems the thing that bothers you about this is the attitude with which it's done.
Maybe the fault, and gosh, it hurts me to say this since I guess you represent the media these days, Patrick, that it does, maybe the media's to blame by getting overly excited about, wow, rootkits are now possible for mobile phones. You know, you could just say that. You don't have to write one. So I just think there's almost like a semantic, if you work for software, you have to be careful with that word, a semantic gap between, the writing of the spyware and what it allows us to infer and learn. It was as research, particularly as postgrad academic research in the Rutgers case, I really don't think that writing a piece of spyware proves anything. It proves you're a smart enough programmer to be able to, use the network stack functions on a mobile phone. But there are already, if you look at the iPhone, hundreds of thousands of developers who know how to do that. What's more interesting is actually going digging to find new mechanisms by which we can either violate security mechanisms which we already believed to be secure, thereby proving that they're not, or by actually coming up, with academic type research with completely new ways of protection, like stuff like, modifying the GCC compiler to have stack protection to protect against stack overflows. Things like WXORX in OpenBSD, which tries to differentiate even on old Intel chips between executable stuff and not executable stuff. Those are the kind of things that really help us in security. But writing spyware sort of seems like an easy way out that gets publicity that it probably doesn't deserve.
And a bit of a waste of resources, I guess, is what you're getting at.
Yeah, maybe if they just started by what defensive stuff can we do? How could we improve the code signing model?
Paul, would you acknowledge that that one of the reasons that this sort of stuff gets done is because it's fun?
Oh, I don't doubt that for a moment.
I mean, it is kind of cool. It's the sort of thing you'd work on over a few beers with mates,
I suppose it's the kind of thing that if you were at university and you had a choice, you can do a code review of a million lines of the world's most boring web server.
Or you can write a BlackBerry Trojan.
Write a bit of funky spyware for this open source Linux phone and we'll buy you three of them for your research. Yes, I can see the point. All other things being equal, you're going to steer clear of the code review and you're going to write the spyware because it's fun. On the other hand, learning how to do an effective code review in a reasonable time of a million lines of the world's most boring web server is actually probably really much more useful in the long run.
Mm-hmm. All right, Paul. Well, it's always interesting to hear your views. Thank you very much for joining us on the show, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again soon.
Cheers, Patrick.
Paul Grumpy Ducklin there on the line from Sydney with a look at mobile malware research, among other things. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview. Each week, our sponsors get to come onto the show to have a bit of a chinwag about various stuff. Without these sponsor interviews, Risky Business doesn't exist. Thanks to the support of companies like this week's sponsor, Checkpoint, we can invest time into recording, editing, and hosting the show. That's just how it works. Anyway, Checkpoint is doing a bit of a product push next week. They've invited a stack of IT journalists to a Swisho restaurant in Sydney to talk to them about a new product, which is essentially, as you'll hear, a virtualized system on a USB device. So it's designed to let people use public systems while reducing the risk posed to corporate data from those systems. So you can apparently plug this thing into a public computer at Sydney Airport, for example, access your corporate network and not have to worry about leaving data, leaving corporate data on the local machine. I mean, if you've ever used an airport terminal, you would have seen all those email attachments saved on the desktop of those computers. I bet you've seen a few. So I spoke to Fred about this little USB doohickey and wondered how useful it actually is going to be, considering using public computers to access corporate assets is almost always a no-no.
Quite often, the customers that we speak with use various types of web applications for collaboration. It could mean accessing your emails through a web interface, or it could mean collaborating with business partners, customers, or perhaps let your third-party contractors or workers into your internal systems just through a web interface. And when you provide this way of accessing information, there's rarely anything that stops people from saving attachments in emails or saving the project plan or the mergers and acquisitions plan on a device you have no control over whatsoever. So it could mean the consultant's PC or workstation. It could mean employees who save very sensitive information on their home PCs. And all of these documents and all of the data that you've been working with inside the corporate systems is through the web interface all of a sudden left behind somewhere in an airport terminal, on a shared PC, hotel. Could be any type of machine that's been used to access these internal systems.
So basically what you're pitching here is some sort of USB device that allows you to access, to provision remote access to certain systems without leaving behind stuff that you shouldn't leave behind.
Correct. And, of course, doing it in a safe way and at the same time, of course, making use of the USB technology to allow you to carry documents with you so that you can, in a safe way, carry documents around and work on them, upload them when you want to, and not requiring the user to have the online access at all times that they wish to work with the corporate data.
Now, an example you used before, Fred, of where this type of solution is useful is people actually accessing sort of corporate web applications and things via terminals in, say, an airport lounge. Wouldn't that be a violation of most sensible corporate security policies?
It could be. Of course, it depends on the type of security policy and what the company is trying to achieve. In many cases, the end customers that we speak with have big problems in enforcing a policy that, for instance, stops someone from accessing corporate assets from a shared computer terminal, for instance, in an airport lounge. Many of the customers do have policies in place but lack the tools to enforce it or lack some type of tool to allow customers to doing this type of access in a secure way.
So how can you actually make sure that people are using this tool to access your web application? Is it like some sort of NAC model?
I wouldn't say a NAC model, but think of it as a concept of virtualizing a workspace and carrying it with you on a USB device.
So it's like a virtualized browser and OS that you can pop into any computer and whiz it up and away you go.
Making it very simple, yes. Technically, we're not really virtualizing the operating system. We're just virtualizing the virtual workspace, making it a very lightweight concept that's quick to start.
So it's like a virtualized file system, right? Because I know you guys have got that browser sandbox thingy that you've had for ages.
It's that plus some things. It's a concept that allows you to fully separate the host PC from the actual virtual workspace that you're carrying with you so that it doesn't really matter what host PC you plug this device into.
Now, look, one thing that I find interesting about this whole idea is that next Tuesday, I mean, you're going to do the whole journalist lunch, right? And I've done a million of these where it's when, you know, you invite a bunch of journalists to a nice restaurant and they think, hey, free food, you know, I'll sit there and I'll sit through the PowerPoint and get the free food and maybe learn something and tootle back off to the office and write some sort of story. What are the challenges involved in crafting a message like this for the IT media in particular? Because it occurs to me that the IT media is an interesting conduit for information, because essentially what you're doing is presenting technical information to people who aren't that technical, who then in turn go and present that to people who are technical. So you've got this sort of weird dumbing down effect that has to happen. I mean, how do you get around that challenge? How do you make sure that the message isn't distorted by going through the media this way?
I think that the best way of presenting things like this is to focus in on sort of end user cases and talking about how to solve real customer problems and staying away as much as we can from technology and from sort of product pitches.
But doesn't that mean that we wind up getting the same sorts of generic messages from a lot of vendors and it's difficult for the market to sort of clearly establish a point of difference?
I don't think so. I guess it depends a lot on who's presenting and exactly how sort of the message is conveyed. But if we focus in on real customer problems and talk about customer problem, real solution, and talk it through that way, I think that we'll have something that is different from the normal sort of product pitch. There's way too much product pitching going on from our vendors and focusing a lot on the customer challenge and solving the customer challenge, how this means benefits from a business perspective and security perspective is the way to go.
Yeah, I must say it's been a challenge for me sometimes. You go to like some big vendor lunch, you know, and they start off by getting up. Someone gets up and says, you know, hacking isn't just for hobbyists anymore. There are professional organizations that write malware, you know, so they're sort of bringing you up to speed on the latest trends of 2002. And I usually wind up asleep in my entree.
Yeah, I promise that we won't do any of that on Tuesday in Sydney.
All right, Frederick Boyerson, thank you very much. Now, I understand your wife has just given birth to your first child, girl or boy?
It's a little boy. It's a little William. He's a very nice chap, lively, but very nice.
I bet you're getting heaps of sleep at the moment.
Not really.
Okay, well, congratulations, Frederick, and we will speak to you again soon, I am sure.
Thank you very much.
New father, Frederick Boyerson there with this week's sponsor interview. Now, I've been running stacks of music by a mate of mine. His name is Lawrence Kennedy, and you can download all of his tracks at lawrencekennedy.com. And this one that you're hearing now is a remix of the classic Land Down Under by Men at Work. Big thanks to our hosting provider, Virtual Office, who are in Sydney. Also, I am in Sydney today because Risky Business is up for an award tonight. Media Connect has assembled a panel of journalists to vote for Australia's Best Technology Audio Program. We are up against podcasts and radio shows from CNET and ZDNet, the Australian Financial Review, Sydney's 2GB, that's a radio station, Australian Macworld, and a bunch of others. But wish us luck. You never know. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.